You're listening to Precinct 444, a podcast network from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Today we're bringing you another episode from the Encore series, where we revisit past museum programs and conversations. Our final episode of A Network of Support for Lasting Change takes a finer look into the possible next steps of updating police culture and training. The panelists discuss community programs and make recommendations which could improve the way law enforcement trains its officers on the cultures and dynamics of the communities they serve. Additionally, questions are raised about the facts and figures of some of these programs and new training initiatives, along with how effectively they've been adopted by police departments and whether younger audiences would follow them. Our esteemed panelists also discuss how police training can adopt new strategies for engaging their communities and also find innovative ways to stay informed about the unique and evolving needs of the public. As a reminder, you'll hear from Axel Threlfall, our moderator and editor-at-large at Reuters, Chief Jeffrey Glover from Tempe, Arizona, Florence Chung, founder and CEO of Engage Public Safety, the Reverend Markel Hutchins, CEO of Movement Forward Incorporated, and Renee Mitchell, president of the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing. With all that said, I present the last episode of A Network of Support for Lasting Change.
Florence, let me start with you on this. What sort of, you work with young people, what sort of cultural training do you think might work? When you speak with the youth, what do they say about the need for culture change and how quickly that can happen?
One of the things that came up during one of our meetings was that had to do with training and the culture of police training. A lot of times, you know, in the law enforcement world, the police are training police. And so, and also there are a lot of training topics that came to the forefront again last year, such as implicit bias training. Some of the things that I've been hearing from young people has been around implicit bias training, saying, you know, I don't know if there's, I've heard that the data is not really strong when it comes to the effectiveness of implicit bias training for police officers. And they said, why not actually provide historical education for police officers instead of implicit bias? Because it's so hard to get to moderate behavior based on, trying to suppress biases that are implicit. So how about education around the history of policing and the conflicts that have been plaguing maybe that particular department, so that officers coming in and even officers that have been there for a long time can have a more empathetic understanding as to what is going on, the mindsets of different communities, especially communities of color, and that education isn't happening in the schools. And so a big part of what the young people were saying is, can we change training so that historical education about conflicts with communities of color, et cetera, can be part of the curriculum in the training and not just push implicit bias training.
Yeah. Reverend Hutchins, what do you feel about about cultural training and what works best?
So the academy can train their hands, but the community has to train an officer's heart. That's what I think Florence is alluding to. You cannot protect and serve communities that you do not know. I think what we're hearing is a lot of community residents are saying they want the law enforcement professionals that police in their communities to know the dynamics and the particular demographics and culture of their communities on a local basis. So what I'm hoping is that, look, we have the best technically trained, strategically, tactically trained law enforcement professionals in America of any other period in American history and any period in world history. So it's not just what we're doing in the academy, but what we're doing outside of the academy. I have a lot of police chiefs and sheriffs that say to me, well, we're doing so many things right, Reverend Hutchins, but just because it's right does not mean that it's adequate. We have to reimagine what training looks like so that it's not just training the skill set of the officers in terms of their tactical abilities, but training their hearts, training their minds. And that happens only through human engagement. You cannot train that in the academy, which is why I'm hopeful that we will begin to expand the definition of training to include more engagement, direct involvement with the people in the communities that, that officers are protecting and serving.
And a bunch of questions coming through on some of these community programs that I'll come on to in a second. But Chief Glover, you know, I guess that's one of the reasons I asked you about recruitment and about how you describe the role of the police officer to a new recruit. The cultural training piece of that is central, isn't it, to that recruitment and the training right at the start?
Absolutely, it is. I mean, and we've done some of the cultural training here in our organization where we've brought in fair and impartial policing and done some of that training. But I think the more important piece that the Reverend and Connie have talked about is, you know, how do you train the heart? You know, how do you get to the heart of a person and be able to change their heart and change their mind? And one of the things that we are currently working on in our organization that we've been working with the group called Telos for a pilot program trip, and it's really building a scalable, immersive learning experience for law enforcement and having our officers understand about racial justice in the U.S., how that's designed and how it came along, and better equip them to understand, some of these dynamics so they can be transformational peacemakers in their communities. It's also designed as an immersive educational program where they are going to take a trip down south. And we are looking at creating this pilot program where we're probably going to take about, in the beginning part of February of 2022, we're going to take about 20 officers through a trip down south. It's going to start in New Orleans, where you're going to hear a lot about slavery and what that was like on the Whitney plantation. They're going to hear it from from people that are historians and get a little bit more insight. Then they're going to learn about information from their institute and the exploitive nature of the money bail system. And then they're going to meet individuals. They're going to go over to Mississippi, where they'll meet with Robert Jones and Jerome Morgan and the Freedom Foundation, and hear about the wrongful convictions and decades long incarcerations that they had endured in prison. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, it's being able to get them to different places like the Lynching Museum and getting them exposed to that. We had a commander that went on that trip with his church group and decided that when he brought it back and said, hey, this is something that I really am passionate about, it really changed my perspective on just, the different issues that are plaguing our country as it deals with race. We need to have, more interaction where the officers actually go out and experience this. And so they'll hit, places in Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi on a 1-week trip where they're exposed to all of these different things. And the expression that he had in terms of his experience with going on this trip was that it was transformational for him. And he came back a different person with a different perspective. And if we can, be successful with really kicking this off, our plan is between 2022 to 2024 is to have at least, 200, 240 people go through this trip and actually experience this, because it's hard to just talk about it. Sure, you can teach the history, but if you're there actually seeing it and tasting it and feeling it, that's a whole nother ballpark.
Yeah. Yeah, Florence, a question to you, and I guess playing devil's advocate a little bit, it's back to something you said previously linked to this, and this question comes through, and I think there's a hint of skepticism here, maybe I'm wrong, but the question is, how many young people are really willing to take the same historical education courses as the police, or perhaps with the police? It's a good question.
Yeah, it is a good question. And, historical education, I would say, if we're talking about facts and data that many times young people don't really see, or they don't have the exposure to, they just don't have access to that information, or maybe it's just not present in the sources and platforms in which they're getting their information, whether that be social media, the news, their friends, or school. I would say they would be open, especially the students that we work with. Now, the students we work with across the country, rural, suburban, urban, left, right, and center. they ran the gamut with this organization, and they just wanted to gain perspective. They are avid consumers of information because it's so easy with these devices now, right? But I think they come with an attitude of wanting to learn and wanting to keep perspective. And that's why we found such success with the students interviewing activists and law enforcement and police psychologists and researchers and those in academia, just trying to get the full kind of lens that could be clear so that they can apply their critical thinking to make some decisions as to how they want to approach this solution-making change-driving process. So for me, I have hope. I have hope that they would be open to that because the groups of people who actually engage and want to get involved are the ones that are genuinely wanting solutions. And so I would say if the groups that we're working with are representative of a large swath of the country, I have hope for the future.
Okay. Look, I've got a wary eye on the time here. There have been a number of questions coming through on, work between on the ground locally between the police departments and the community. Rene, let me ask you this, and Reverend Hutchins, let me ask you this too. Give us an example of some of the current programs that excite you most, that work most effectively, that can be copied in other parts of the country. You want to go ahead, Reverend Hutchins?
So I really am really excited, and this may sound self-serving, but it's really not. I'm really excited about National Faith and Blue Weekend. Last year in April, we hosted a meeting of the Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, the IACP, National Sheriffs, Major City Chiefs, all the national law enforcement groups. And we proposed this idea of a single weekend in October where we could really focus the nation on having these kinds of conversations that we're having right now in every local community and in every local neighborhood. With 3 months of planning, we saw 1,000 events for National Faith and Blue Weekend. We're planning for Faith and Blue Weekend 2021. October 8th through the 11th. And in that event will give an opportunity to have these kinds of conversations and build collaboration, build rapport in local communities and in local neighborhoods. I think what we continue to hear in this conversation and what we hear in all of these kinds of discussions is that there's not a one size fixes all. It has to be locally driven. These conversations, the solutions must be locally based. So we're really excited about Faith in Blue Weekend 2021. And those are some of the things that can happen. Every community organization, every community leader, every law enforcement agency ought to be having this very discussion in their local communities, because the answers to the challenges that face that community emanate locally and they will grow out of those discussions. So we're really excited about that. And while I have this opportunity, I want to say thank you to you, Axel, and all of the panelists and all of our viewers and engagers in this discussion on behalf of the Board of Directors of the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund and Museum. Thank you for joining us for this discussion. It's really been a wonderful start to conversations that we hope will continue to be hosted by our organization and by those of you who are engaging today.
Thank you, Reverend Hutchins. And look, we've got a few minutes left, so if you can stay with us, that will be marvelous. Rene, I don't know if you want to say something about the some of the programs you've seen that work most effectively. And actually, on the back of that, let me throw this in. I wanted to ask this when I talked about data and technology before. Given, let's face it, the reality of shrinking budgets, to what extent does that limit what police departments can do? What the sort of data they can get their hands on, the sort of technology they can get their hands on.
Well, I was going to say, when it comes to like looking at their data, and technology is different, that's a whole new conversation. But when you're looking at engaging your community or using your data to drive some of your engagements, when you're asking me like what programs work or what's shown to be effective, because both for the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing and RTI International, coming from a research point of view, we look at trying to evaluate programs and practices to look at if you are getting the outcomes you actually think you're achieving. That is one of the things where when we talk about how rapidly police, the profession has been moving, we are behind the other professions as far as showing that any of our, I shouldn't say any, but a lot of our practices are even effective or working to reduce crime, to improve community engagement or any of those things. So for me, we're still kind of infants in the field for showing effectiveness and efficiencies. But what I've seen from the research is, for example, a program that David Weisbord has done where he's paired up mental health clinicians along with police officers that are doing outreach in high crime areas that are called hotspots, and showing that you kind of need a two-sided approach if you want to help your communities that are suffering from PTSD or other type of mental health issues because they live in these high crime areas, is that you need to reduce the crime so they feel safe, but at the same time, get them connected to resource and help them with their mental health issues. And it was a small pilot, and they're just starting to put out some of the research now, but they're showing that, you know, that increased engagement with the clinicians and knocking on people's doors, that the community was very receptive to learning what the police department was attempting to do, that they were good with the police department being in their areas trying to reduce crime, and that they appreciated the outreach for the mental health clinician being in their communities. So for like the two areas that I represent, it's really about examining if what you're doing and how you're doing it works. And I think there's free tools that researchers and academics are developing so that agencies can evaluate themselves if their practices are working in the field. And if anybody wants those, they could always contact me. I'm more than happy to help people put them in touch with those resources and or on follow-ups with this when this gets posted to put in, to put those websites and contexts out there.
A final question, Chief Glover, before I get some closing thoughts from all of you. In terms of dedicated community liaisons, I saw a question come through earlier. I can't find it now. It seems to have disappeared. But you know, local community policing on bicycles, on foot, the sort of thing we see in little villages in England, in the north of England, the bobby, the local bobby. How great a role does that play? Can that play?
I think it can play a significant role. I mean, here in Tempe, we have a downtown district. We have Arizona State University that's right here in the heart of the city, and it's near the downtown. So having bike officers be that ambassador of being able to engage and communicate and provide education to our college students here within the city is very critical. We partner with Arizona State University on a great number of things, and including to making sure that we're connected with fraternities and sororities to make sure that they're staying safe. And that's usually done through our bike officers. We have a couple of bike officers that are crime prevention specialists. And so, you know, they're used to going out, giving those presentations and connecting with the student population, as well as our community affairs specialist that we have that works here out of the office of the chief. They also make those connections as well. And they're ingrained in everything that's going on community-wise, so that way we're getting that feedback from our neighborhood associations, homeowners associations, especially when you have the dynamic of being one of the largest, campuses in the nation here at Arizona State University, and it's in the middle of your city. It's difficult because you have a lot of we don't have a fraternity row. I mean, they live with, you know, many of the students live within the community. And so it's about being a good neighbor and making sure that we're doing that education because you have an older population that's intermingled with a very young population. And so sometimes that dynamic can be a little bit challenging, but that, you know, that we utilize those particular positions to help with bridging the gap.
Yeah. Okay. Look, I want to get some closing thoughts from each of you. I mean, this has been a really rich conversation. We've touched on a lot of areas. I mean, there are certain areas we haven't touched on. The delicate issue of unions, et cetera, et cetera. And I won't go there now. But let me ask you this question. I'll start with you, Reverend Hutchins. the Center for Justice Research at Texas Southern calls this, and we've heard similar quotes from elsewhere, calls it an unprecedented opportunity right now to reimagine policing. What do you feel when you hear things like that, Reverend Hutchins? Do comments like that excite you, or do they scare you in the sense that you know how tough a culture change will be?
You know, it really does excite me. I don't think we've ever, as a nation, run away or shied away from difficult moments. In fact, I think our darkest hours as a nation, as well as individuals, are always just before the brink of a new dawning. So in my estimation, we really are at a pivotal and yet a powerful moment in American history. And I don't think it's just relative to policing. I think policing is the tip of the iceberg, but we will emerge from this moment in American history with safer communities because we're focused on innovation. We're focused on having these difficult conversations, and we're focusing on charting a path forward. We will rise from this moment. There's no doubt in my mind, but we have to be intentional about focusing on the things that we agree about and not getting so distracted about the things that we disagree about. When every law enforcement professional, every community leader, every business leader, every media leader, every law enforcement executive, when we sit together, good things happen. When we work together, public safety is increased and communities feel more confident that their rights are being protected and promoted. I think we are in a powerful place. We just can't afford to miss this opportunity. And frankly, I don't think we will.
Okay. Florence, are you as excited? I guess from what you've said, I'm guessing you are.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of work ahead. The road to change is long and windy, but I think there are a lot of different groups that are at it. And this CALEB network that's launching will facilitate, I think, inspiration and hope for all of us who are in this work. I would say, what we tell our young people is to get engaged. Simple. You can't fix what you don't understand. So we're asking them to check their internal biases at the door and get involved. Actually go meet with their local police departments. And that can be an intimidating thing for young people. But we say, posting on social media, joining a protest on the streets is one thing, but to see real change, there needs to be engagement. They have to be willing to talk to law enforcement, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. And so for us, we'll be releasing a local engagement toolkit coming up soon to give young people actionable steps on how to engage with law enforcement if they choose to take that up, right? In the cities that they live in, whether it's going on a ride along, starting a police advisory youth council to offer the Gen Z perspective and offer a young person's focus group for a police chief, whatever the idea may be. I think young people, we can give them some real actionable concrete steps. And I think, the National Law Enforcement Museum, is great for launching this network to facilitate these types of ideas, because I foresee that we'll have a lot of ideas being generated in the future. And now we have a platform to go to.
Okay. Renee, how about you?
I hope I'm not, I'm probably the cynic in the group, and maybe it's the cop in me. And I am excited about it, and I hope there is police reform. My worry is just like when Lyndon B. Johnson put together his national program for police reform in the 60s, the research was left behind. So you ended up with the same programs and protocols that you've seen decade to decade to decade, and the American Society of Evidence-Based Policing and every, I would say, academic and researcher that's involved in the criminal justice field advocates for the same thing, is you see programs go by the wayside with no research that shows you what works and what doesn't work. And we keep just creating new programs or new platforms with these, the buzzwords of the day. And then the next decade, we have a new buzzword, and then you don't see real, true fundamental change. Whereas if we actually did some of the research and at the federal level, it got funded the way it should be funded. And we used the data to drive what we should be doing in the field and became more evidence-based, like the medical field. We could probably make the leaps and bounds that the medical field's made in the last few decades. So that's where, like, like I said, I'm a little bit cynical. I want the police reform. I want us to make the changes, but I would like to see it driven by the research and the data rather just opinions and platitudes. Yep.
Okay, good. Renny, thank you. And Chief Glover, to finish up with you, you know, back to that quote, an unprecedented opportunity to reimagine policing. I mean, you're sitting on the inside. You see what's going on. You speak to the new recruits. You see the level of morale. You realize that this has to happen, you know, quickly, you know, as people leave the force in droves. What characterize the hope you feel?
You know, I have a lot of hope for police reform, but you know, Renee's point. I mean, you do have to have some data behind some of the things, the initiatives that are behind it. You don't want to do the flavor of the day and have to go back to the drawing board in another 2 years. And so it's important to be able to you know, make sure that, you know, what you're doing is actually something that's going to be sustainable and that will work. And that's sort of what we're striving for here. And some of the changes that we're trying to make is that we want to make sure that it's long term sustainable change, as opposed to just change for the sake of change. We want to make sure that we're getting it right. And that what we're doing is creating a progressive police department that has the trust of its community. That's the most important thing that you know, that we can do. And so, you know, in terms of the reform and how we come about that, it's like, you know, unfortunately, it's like steering a huge cruise ship. I mean, it doesn't just change, you know, at the stop of a dime and change directions. You know, so some of that is incremental, and, you know, being able to roll that out, it just takes time, but we're very hopeful that the time spent in doing a lot of this groundwork, is that, you know, we're going to have a department in the years to come that's going to be, you know, very finely in tune with everything that's going on, reform related, and that will be at the pinnacle of that.
Okay, very, very good. And there, everyone, I have to stop it, I'm afraid. Look, as I said, you know, it's been a really fascinating discussion, a very rich discussion, a clearly an extremely important discussion. A very engaged audience. You know, I thank all of you for your questions. I mean, it's always a sign of how engaged the audience is. You know, the number of good questions coming through. I hope I got to as many of them as I could in the time. So thank you to you, Florence Chung, Chief Glover, Reverend Hutchins, Renee Mitchell. Thank you very, very much indeed.
A network of support for lasting change is all about bridging the gap between law enforcement and the communities they serve through improved communication on both sides. CALEB, the Community Alliances and Law Enforcement Bulletin Network, hopes to be that bridge. The CALEB Network is a platform that strives for open dialogue to effectively identify problems or concerns and find effective solutions. As a reminder, you can find more information on the CALEB Network on our website, lawenforcementmuseum.org. We invite you to engage the desktop version of the app, or even better, download the app to your mobile device. As we conclude our look back at a network of support for lasting change, our hope is that everyone involved sees the value of creating a safe space where law enforcement professionals from all over the country can come together to talk and share their experiences. We want the CALEB Network to be a part of the change that we want to see. As always, thanks to Anna Muckenfuss, our Manager of Programs and Education Initiatives, for helping write today's program, and of course, Christopher Mitchell, our Manager of Digital Content and Strategy, for producing. And thank you for listening to this episode of Encore, a Precinct 444 podcast from the National Law Enforcement Museum. Join us next time for another look back at some of our best programs from the past. Please subscribe to Precinct 444 on your favorite podcasting platform to stay connected and to receive our latest content as soon as it drops. And we would love to hear from you. Send in your questions, comments, and feedback to Precinct 444 at nleomf.org. You can help us make our content even better. The National Law Enforcement Museum is located at 444 East Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., and is dedicated to telling the story of American law enforcement. We expand and enrich the relationship between law enforcement and the community through educational journeys, immersive exhibitions, and insightful programs. Find us online at lawenforcementmuseum.org. Until next time, stay safe. We'll see you at the precinct.